This is a CBC podcast. University is a time in our lives when everything changes. It's made up of those defining moments that really make us who we are. Campus, CBC's new podcast series, looks into the struggles to overcome the anxieties of leaving home, finding friends, fitting in, and feeling lost. Download it today at cbc.ca/campus.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. This is The Current. Paul Knoll and his sister Helen Reese and her husband live together in Ottawa. Paul has Down syndrome, and last year, after their mother died, it changed their lives completely.
In the old days, in my parents, on my life, my family just died. So difficult to lose our parents. And like in the old days, like me and my mom and dad are always hiding Easter eggs in the backyard.
He knows he only has me. I'm his only blood relative. We don't have any aunts or uncles or brothers or sisters. So, and he knows that without me, he's very vulnerable.
Well, that is Helen and Paul. Before that, Paul and Helen, sister and brother. Over the past year, Helen has stepped into the role of being Paul's caregiver, and it has been quite a year. In fact, when she went to blog about the past year's experiences, she decided to call that blog her failure report. What she wrote is both a call for reflection and a call to action, with a look at how families care for loved ones with intellectual disabilities and the role of community and government. Helen and Paul are part of an important demographic shift as increasing numbers of Canadians with intellectual disabilities outlive their parents. Helen Reese joins us from Ottawa. Hello.
Hi.
Tell me a little more about Paul.
Paul is 43 years old. He works at Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. He's been there for almost 22 years, delivering the mail and contributing in different ways in that workplace. Besides his work life, he's a very busy man. He loves the arts. I always say that my brother is a true Renaissance man. He's all about galleries, classical music, and the good life.
We just heard him talk about your parents. Mm-hmm. He misses them, huh?
Very much so, as do I.
It's got to be hard for both of you. You're grieving your mother at the same time as everything else in your life is changing.
That's right, yes.
Well, tell me a little bit about what that's been like.
Well, my mom died about a year ago this week. I guess the last year has really passed in a blur. And, I've been trying to do two different things, it feels like. One of them is to recover from the intense grief that I've been feeling. And the other one is to build up a new life for me and my brother and my husband so that we can have a sustainable life together and everybody can live happily. It's been quite arduous. I've been really struggling this year to try and get that all in order.
Mm. So your mother was a caregiver for Paul?
Yes. My mother and father were his primary caregivers his entire life. My father died in 2011 very suddenly, and my mother also died very suddenly.
Okay, so this was very unexpected. This wasn't mm-hmm. something you were talking about over time. It just kind of happened.
That's right. Although I'm sure with many families who have a member who has an intellectual disability, the discussion of whether what would happen as the primary caregivers die, that is a discussion that our family sometimes would have. It always felt like a fictitious discussion. It never really felt like it would something that would actually come true, and definitely not something that would come true so quickly.
What expectations did you have for yourself as you took over the role of Paul's caregiver?
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought that being his caregiver could be very straightforward. I mean, our family was always very close, so I always had an active part in my brother's life, and my parents were very open with me. So I thought it would be something that I could pick up quite easily. So my employer kindly gave me a year off of work unpaid that I could use to sort out all the things that I needed to sort out for Paul. And since Paul's parents died, I thought that developmental services, Paul would be a priority in with developmental services, which is, I believe, a branch of MCSS or funded by them.
And is that a provincial agency?
Of Ontario, that's
okay.
Right.
Okay.
So I thought that, you know, given Paul's situation was truly a crisis, that we would perhaps qualify for some additional passport funds so that I could hire people to support Paul in his daily life, and that wouldn't be something that I would have to do.
What's a passport fund?
So passport funding is a funding model where families receive a certain amount of money per year to spend to help include their family members in the community. So it's a individually directed funding where the families can determine what is best for their family member, and direct the funding towards what that might be. So in my brother's case, he's a very active person in the community. And, you know, I would use passport funding, let's say, for an independent living support worker who might come and see Paul once a week and help him to ensure his clothes are clean. They don't do the work for them. A support worker doesn't do that work for them. They just support Paul in doing that work himself, or ensure maybe they'll do batch cooking with him. So he'll have some meals in the freezer that he can use when, let's say, I'm not there to cook for him, or he just wants to eat something different.
And so when you first you took that year off to mm-hmm. try to do all that, you were trying to replicate how your parents were with him, right? They were very hands-on, were they?
That's right. So my brother is the first generation of people with intellectual disabilities who are really living in the community. So my mother and father wanted for Paul the best life. They themselves didn't have any role models or any resources to help them do that because they were the first ones to do that. And so the way they did it is by, you know, always being there to facilitate Paul's needs. So taking him where he needed to go or helping him resolve problems. And they did it out of love and compassion. But I really think they probably did more for Paul than what he actually needed, because he is a very capable person.
And when you tried to do that, what happened?
That didn't really work very well for me at all. So I tried to replicate what my parents did because I wanted to maintain a level of stability for my brother. But, you know, I couldn't do it. I needed to live my own life. And the more I was living in service to my brother, the less successful it was. Also, I think my brother didn't want that. I mean, well, I know he didn't want that. Who wants their sister in their face all day long? So he became quite resentful of me and angry. And I think it also compounded his grief.
Mm. I have another bit of tape. CBC Ottawa reporter Hallie Cottenham was with you at home with Paul. So she recorded a bit more conversation, and we picked a little bit of that. Let's listen.
Do you like living with your sister and brother-in-law?
Yes, I do.
Why?
Because I love them on my heart, and I love it here. I'm so lucky to have my sister and my brother-in-law.
What about when we fight?
This I don't like.
What do you fight about?
I don't know. Helen, you mind?
No, I don't mind. Go ahead. Tell her, what do we fight about? Facebook.
By Facebook.
What's the problem with Facebook? Using it in the middle of the night?
Yeah.
Who does that? Helen?
No, me.
Okay. Instead of sleeping, you're on the computer?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're not getting enough sleep?
Yes.
And then are you crabby the next day?
No.
Oh, yes. That's the big problem. Being crabby the next day.
Mm. Helen, how has your relationship with Paul changed then in the last year?
I would say for the positive. So although I have always been a caring and compassionate sister with my brother, I think I never gave him enough credibility for knowing what he needs for himself in his own life. I made always a lot of assumptions, and I didn't listen to him deeply and patiently. And so in the last year, I have learned to respect what he knows about himself. I've learned to let go of my bossy tendencies, big sister tendencies, and really let him be his own person. And I think he appreciates that, as do I. And I'm really starting to see what an amazing, I mean, I always knew he was an amazing guy, but I really see it more clearly now.
It's interesting. It's different to be a sibling caregiver than a parent caregiver, huh?
It's very different. I have had people say to me, you're a mother now. And I really quite resent that, because we are not at all in a hierarchical parental relationship. So my brother, my husband, and I are in a space sharing agreement in our house. We are equals. We have equal decision-making authority. We decide things together and work on things together. Of course, I'm making it sound very idealistic, but, it's a work in progress, of course.
And so have you gone back to work?
No, I can't go back to work. So it's going to take a long time for me to resolve how our house flows, and also learning what you need to, in terms of administration, being a person with a disability in Ontario. It is a massive caseload. So basically I'm doing advanced case management for my brother. And I need to recreate myself professionally in order to have employment where I'm working in a flexible schedule, preferably working from home. So I'm busy doing that right now.
And so what have you learned about the support system for caregivers for people with disabilities?
Well, I've learned that there actually isn't one. So the system, quote unquote system, that we have is very dysfunctional. The two branches of MCSS that I have been working with are ODSP, the Ontario Disability Support Program, and Developmental Services. And the programs are siloed. They don't talk to each other. And it's really, really what they do is serve as a gatekeeping function. The people who work on the front line, you know, they're good-hearted and well-intentioned, but they really have nothing to offer families. And it's been a year since my mom died, and we don't have anything, any valuable resources to use. The other piece is...
I'm going to stop you. What is MCSS?
Sorry, it's the Ministry of Community and Social Services.
Okay. Again, on Ontario.
I only know the system in Ontario because that's...
No, fair enough. This is what you're mm-hmm. living through, right?
This is what I'm living.
Okay. Well, what do you need from them that you can't get?
What I need are some resources that have some value. So what I get offered are resources that don't match my ideology around what people with disabilities need.
Like
so
what?
I'll give you a perfect example. I have a caseworker come swanning over to our house, and they offer me as respite for my brother to go to a farm outside of the city. So my brother is not a dog. I don't care if the place has the word happy in it. My brother belongs in his community, so I need resources to support him so that he can be in the community and that I am not the only vehicle to do that.
And so instead of that respite trip, what would you have liked them to say?
They could have provided me with a list. Well, I think they do have this actually, a list of independent living support workers that you can hire, but without any funding to hire them, I can't do that. And the other interesting piece that I've found, I really believe in dialogue. And what I find very interesting is that nobody has ever sat down with me and said to me, what do you think your brother needs? And let's try and drop a budget. Let's have a conversation around how we can support your brother in the community. So instead, what it looks like is let's go through a reassessment and let's remind your brother, because it's a quote unquote inclusive process, which means that your family member needs to sit through this. And for 2 days, let's remind that person how much he cannot do. which is basically what the reassessment process through developmental services does. It takes 2 days to complete, and you sit in a room with a worker, and it was question after question about what Paul cannot do. And Paul was devastated by that. He still talks about it. He was doing self-harm after that interview, and he still asks me sometimes, is the caseworker coming to take me away?
Hmm. Was there any trust fund or anything that you had access to?
There is. So my parents were very progressive. They were the first people in Ottawa to open an RDSP account. So my parents did save for the Registered Disability Support Program. Paul can't access that until he's older, until he's 65. My parents also saved a little bit of money in what's called a Henson Trust. And a Henson Trust is a discretionary trust fund where you can use that money to support the person in their life. So I was under the impression that I would have, as a non-discretionary trust, I would have access to that and be able to use that as I saw fit for my brother, because my parents made me the executor of that trust. But actually, I can't do that. Paul can only receive $6,000 above and beyond his ODSP payment. So
ODSP, Ontario
Disability Support Program. Okay. Okay. So $6,000 does not give you a lot of freedom. And what I love about that is they call it a gift. I think that's just such a slap in the face that, you know, you fund people at the poverty line or below, and you have a line on the paper that is for a gift. You know, it's not a gift. It's a contribution to support somebody living a smidgen above the poverty line.
So if your parents had put that money in a different place, you would be able to access it to do more for your brother.
Well, you're still always accountable to ODSP. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ODSP, what they're perfect at is it's the perfect poverty trap. So you're always accountable for the flow of money around the family member with a disability. So, you know, it would have been, in a way, it would have been better if my parents had saved outside the Henson Trust. But they did what they thought was best in that moment. It is what it is. I just have to work with it.
And essentially you're saying that the provincial government, in this case Ontario, responsible for this, isn't actually open to what's actually happening out there, isn't actually addressing how things are evolving?
I don't think so. I mean, just from my years' experience, I think it's a very ableist government. Their perspective is a hangover from the time when family members were institutionalized. It doesn't support being in the community. And the other piece is that this funding has gone to, I believe funding has gone to a lot of agencies. And there are many agencies, but they're not all created equal. So if you're lucky, you get picked up by an agency who is also progressive and has the same ideologies that you do. But there are an awful lot of very large agencies that still support the old model that our family members should be warehoused, stuffed away somewhere, and not be seen.
Helen, thanks for sharing your experiences and your thoughts with us.
Thank you.
Helen Reese is caring for her brother Paul Noel in Ottawa. She wrote a blog post about her first year as a sibling caregiver, and we have posted a link to it on our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent. Now, we did ask for an interview with Helena Jazzik, Ontario's Minister of Community and Social Services. She was not available. Her office sent us a statement, and I'll read it in part. Quote, in 2014, the Ontario government invested $810 million over 3 years to improve developmental services, including providing new funding directly to clients and families. Approximately 20,000 adults are currently receiving direct funding through the Passport program, allowing families to purchase the services they need, including respite for caregivers. End quote. Well, my next guest has spent 3 decades helping parents plan to ensure their children with disabilities have independence and freedom after their parents' death. Al Atmansky is the co-founder of the Planned Lifetime Advocacy Network, or PLAN. His organization is focused on just this issue, the long-term future of people with disabilities. And he joins us from Surrey, BC. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
When you hear about Helen's efforts and her frustrations, how representative is that of what families with people with disabilities are going through across the country?
Well, isn't she marvelous? And her relationship with her brother just shines through. So thank you for doing that. Helen is not alone. She's representative of tens of thousands of family members who are doing exactly what she's doing, which is taking care lovingly, reciprocally, capably, caringly. And this is happening all over Canada. I've seen some stats, Anna Maria, that suggest that 80% of the care for people with disabilities in Canada is done by families and friends. Only 20% is paid for. So Helen is representative of the backbone of our caring system for people with disabilities.
Is there anywhere that does it a little better in the country, that where she wouldn't face those same frustrations?
I don't want to get into a comparison of provinces. Some provinces do it better, certainly, than others. But I think there's a fundamental flaw in the system, which is that it doesn't respect this abundance of care and resources that are available out there. And so it brings its funding and its service delivery apparatus from the mindset that we know best, and we're going to tell you what to do and limit your options, as opposed to recognizing that people like Helen are, in fact, the fundamental resource that they can draw on. So they never set the table in a way in which they allow for the full creativity and ingenuity of families to come into play.
Mm. Are there things that that her experience points up that are can be navigated ahead of time? If you're a parent who's the primary caregiver, and you know that someone else will have to look after your adult child, are there things that should be thought about that people don't usually talk about?
Well, I think Helen has covered them in her conversation with you, but on a very practical basis, it's very important to have a will in place. And there are lots of resources in Canada to help with that. They can contact our organization and we can refer you to people across the country. What that does is preserve the amount of wealth you're leaving for the individual with a disability in a way through trusts and through the Registered Disability Savings Plan, so that those resources are available for the individual. The second thing I would recommend in our experiences is to develop a personal network or a circle of friends or a circle of support. Can you imagine existing without the loving care of family and friends? None of us can. And sometimes we have to be much more intentional and conscious about that for our family members with disabilities. At least that's what we found. So that would be my second recommendations. There's many, many, many other things, but I think those two get you started because they address the two most fundamental handicaps of people with disabilities, and that is their social isolation and their poverty.
Mm, and she speaks, she's the only sibling. So yes, I mean, there would be people without siblings who don't have a place to turn, right?
Yes. And everybody deserves, number one, to be in friendship. And every single person with a disability that I've met wants to not only have a friend, but also has a contribution to make to that friendship. We kind of need a ripple effect in the disability world, Anna Maria, similar to this marvelous series that you're running more generally, because if you peel behind what Helen is talking about here, she's got a mindset that she's offering to rethink how we support people with disabilities and their families. And ripple effects start with that kind of shift of mind. And how marvelous it would be if there was a legitimate conversation among families, people with disabilities, and their governments, in which they sat together as equals with respect for what each other brings to the table. And there was a significant redesign rather than this incremental catch-as-catch-can response to crisis all the time. I know Helen's ready. I know families like Helen are ready, and I know people with disabilities are, but we have no government that has really said, we trust families and people with disabilities. You are the key to the redesign.
And you were part of developing the Registered Disability Savings Plan policy, were you not? The RDSP?
Yes, that's right.
But that's for after 60, am I right?
No, it's actually not. There's a 10-year holdback in the fund. So if you put the money in today, then you have to wait 10 years if it's receiving a matching grant from government or the bond. And Anna Maria, the bond is $1,000 a year. No questions asked. You don't even have to put a contribution through. So no, our original conceptualization was that it should be available to as an assist before the individual got too old, so that they can have the money and the wealth to do what they need to do now. So there is a 10-year holdback, but other than that, you can access the funds. Obviously, a few more complications, but that's essentially it.
Okay, well, Al, thank you for your perspective, and it's important that we talk about this. Thanks for your time today.
Great piece. Thanks so much.
Al Etmansky, co-founder of Planned Lifetime Advocacy Network, or PLAN. He joined us from Surrey, BC. He's written about his experience in advocacy for people with intellectual disabilities in his book. It's called Impact, Six Patterns to Spread Your Social Innovation. That's Al Etmansky in Surrey, BC. Now, we're interested in hearing your experience as a parent or sibling caregiver of someone with a disability. Send us an email by going to our website, cbc.ca/thecurrent, and then click on the contact link and let us know. You can always find us on Facebook or on Twitter. We are at The Current CBC. That's our program for today. Stay with Radio 1 for Q. Guest host Jill Deakin will speak to Jen Richards. She's the writer and co-creator of the web series Her Story. That's being hailed as a groundbreaking series in the way that it treats the stories of transgender people. So Jill Deakin speaking to Jen Richards today on Q. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. Thank you for listening to The Current.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.